Worth Repeating is made possible by series sponsorship from the 8020 Foundation, the City of San Antonio Department of Arts and Culture, and the Lifshutz Foundation.
Some of the stories may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Worth Repeating podcast. I'm Tori Poole. This is the second part of the live storytelling event recorded at the Irma and Emilio Nicolas Media Center at Texas Public Radio in downtown San Antonio. The theme was inherited, stories about things that are passed down. Can you think of something that you have that was gifted from someone else? Our next storyteller is Joe DeMott. Joe shares a story about the things his family does while most of us are asleep.
This story is dedicated to all insomniacs. Picture this. I'm 7 years old. My grandmother tells me she wakes up at night. My sins rise up to haunt me, she says with a little laugh. And then she says when this happens, she doesn't get mad or aggravated. She will knit, sew, read, until she gets sleepy and goes back to bed. Years later, I realize that she was trying to tell me about a family sleep disorder that I might inherit and how best to deal with it. We've got sleep talkers in the family and sleep singers. Once my little niece dreams that she is an opera star and starts singing Queen of the Night at the top of her lungs. She wakes up the whole house. The family goes to her room, wakes her up, tells her she's having a dream, and it's time to bring the curtain down on her performance. And I've got a nephew who's at the University of Georgia. He comes home on vacation, but dreams that he's still back at a Georgia Bulldog football game. He starts doing the Bulldog chant. Woof, 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 woof. Woof, woof. Not only sleep chanters, but also sleep walkers in the family. One cold winter night, my mom is driving down the street to our house, and she looks out, and there's some little kid walking. Who let that child out in the middle of the night, she says. Then realizes it's her own 5-year-old son, Jim, who, while dreaming, got up out of bed and went outside walking. Mom picks him up and takes him home gently. You might remember that we used to think that if you startled a sleepwalker, they could die. She ties Jim into bed with sheets, ties him snugly, like you tie your shoes. And recently, my granddaughter told me about her dream that she's late for high school. She climbs down the ladder from her bunk bed and goes to the dresser and starts pulling clothes out. Her sister hears the commotion and says, "It's 3 a.m. You're having a dream. Go back to bed." Come to find out, I'm a sleepwalker. One day I'm taking a nap in the afternoon. My wife comes home, I hear a noise, it disturbs me, I think the house is on fire, I jump up and try to get out the window. "Stop," my wife says. That wakes me up. Then my wife says, "What is your problem?" Another time, I dream I'm at the beach. The palm trees, the sunshine, the sand, the waves rolling in. I'm enjoying it. But then I decide I need to go back to the condo. I pick up my favorite beach towel, wrap it around myself, and start walking back. I wake up when I step off the end of the bed, fall onto the floor, dragging the blanket. Yes, my friends, life really can be a beach. My wife, still in the bed, says, "What is your problem?" In addition, I have another issue. I wear a plastic night guard on my teeth to protect them from the grinding at night. Last summer, while I'm asleep, it comes loose from my teeth and heads towards the back of my throat. I can feel it going. I try to catch it. I try to stop it, but I can't. I swallow it. What to do now? Ask Google. Google says, "Not to worry. This too shall pass." Those of us who suffer from apnea stop breathing altogether while asleep. I used to have this recurring dream. I'm swimming underwater, but I need a breath. I start swimming as fast as I can to the top. I burst through the top, gasping for breath. My wife beside me in the bed says, "You have a sleep disorder. You need to go to a sleep doctor." I said, "No, the doctor's going to want to hook me up to one of those machines that blow air into my lungs all night. I don't want a machine to sleep. I'm a natural man." My wife says, "Look, I got a deal for you. You go to the sleep doctor. If he says you have no problem, I'll quit bitching about it. If he says you do have a problem, you can get the help you need." I tell the sleep doctor how I get up at night, like my grandmother who would knit, sew, read. The sleep doctor says this was a common sleep pattern in the Middle Ages. I say, "Doc, you're not the first one to tell me I'm medieval." Then I say, "I might have possible apnea." He hooks me up to some monitors, has me go to sleep. Next morning, he looks at the results. "You have a serious sleep disorder. In a lot of countries, I'd be taking the car keys away from you. Do you ever feel drowsy at the wheel?" I admit that sometimes I'm apt to doze off while waiting for the light to turn green. So, natural man that I am, I now go to sleep with a plastic night guard on my teeth and a machine blowing air into my lungs. The force is with me, folks. What do I do when I wake up at night? My grandmother would knit, sew, read. I read, write, think. Sleep disorders are the way of our people. My grandmother told me I should find a gracious and constructive way to live with them. Thank you very much. Goodbye, good night, and sleep well.
Joe inspires us to be productive while awake and also while asleep.
This program was made possible with support from the 80/20 Foundation, striving to transform San Antonio by issuing grants to public charities that attract, grow, and retain San Antonio's future workforce. For this and more information, visit 8020foundation.com.
Worth Repeating returns this fall, and I want to hear from you. Take some time and tell us what you thought of this past season. Suggest some themes for next year, or maybe just give us our flowers. Visit tpr.org/WR and fill out the survey today. Not a survey guy or gal? You can shoot me an email directly at worthrepeating@tpr.org. Our next storyteller is Lydia Santos. Lydia shares a story about the importance of making each moment count.
"I'm not frightened of dying. Any time will do, I don't mind. Why should I be frightened of dying? There's no reason for it. You've got to go sometime." This line, as some of you might know, is spoken at the beginning of Pink Floyd's Great Gig in the Sky off the Dark Side of the Moon album. If you're not familiar, it's a 4-minute song with this woman just like belting runs. There's no other words. You know the one. So my brother and I are known to duet this at karaoke, and it's a huge hit. Again, there are no words. It's just like vocalizations. We happen to be intimately familiar with the song thanks to our mom, Linda. Picture this. It's summer 1998, and I'm 8 years old. We are on a road trip to Arroyo Seco, New Mexico to spend the summer with some friends. Linda is 51, and we are traveling west in her 50th birthday gift, her dream car, a Jaguar XJ6 in British Racing Green. And the license plate reads Gone to Seed, which is fitting for a Master Gardener's midlife crisis car. Also notable is the Still Trippin' bumper sticker, which is proudly displayed in the center of the back windshield so that it glows red with the brake lights. But the key feature on this particular trip is the 6-CD changer in the trunk, which contains 6 identical copies of Dark Side of the Moon. Yeah. So I did the math, and on this 12-hour road trip, we would listen to Dark Side of the Moon approximately 17 times. Yeah, so you could say my mom was eccentric. She certainly didn't do anything halfway. She was born in a small mining town in McMeekin, West Virginia, and she had lived quite a life before she met my dad, her third husband. And I know, scandalous. At the time, she was working as a physical therapist at UC Davis in Sacramento. She was 38. My dad was 27. Okay, yeah, some of y'all are doing the math right now. And he was the hot new Chicano rehab resident at the hospital from Laredo, Texas. And so they struck up a conversation in the parking lot. They started dating. And pretty early on in their relationship, she had a proposal for him. She was approaching 40 and had always wanted to be a mom. And he could have as much or as little involvement as he desired, but he seemed like a pretty good genetic candidate for this endeavor. I mean, can't you tell? So my dad is a little bit more on the traditional side, and he proposed marriage unsuccessfully a few times before being told that he needed to chill and wait till they had been dating for at least a year. But my mom ended up breaking the one-year rule and proposed to him on a trip to Argentina, to which he said, yes, but please get up off the floor. So they came back to Texas. She had my brother at 40 and me at 43. And having sown her wild oats throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, she was ready to settle down and be a full-time stay-at-home mom. But like everything else, she was not about to do this halfway. So she was fully committed into raising 2 gifted and talented children without ever going to preschool or daycare. My brother and I both started kindergarten already able to read and write, and that was all thanks to her. When we did start school, she would be waiting for us every day when we got off the bus to ask, did you make any good mistakes today? So you could say that our childhood was pretty idyllic, but little did we know it was only about to get better. When I was in the first grade, my parents went on a trip to Europe. They went to France and Spain to hike in the Pyrenees. And when they came back, I was gifted this elaborate pop-up book of Monet's garden and lily pond. And I was 6 years old, but I insisted that we all go back, and I had to see this for myself. And unfortunately, I was told that I'd have to wait until I graduated from high school. So imagine my surprise when only less than 1 year later, I was pulled out of school and my family went to France, and I got to see Monet's enormous, I'm talking like 42-foot water lily paintings. And we went to his house and saw the garden. We saw the lily pond. And I was like, this is awesome. You know, this was 11 years before I graduated high school, but I wasn't about to question it. You know, you want to take me to Europe? That's the offer still stands. You want to take me to Europe? So suddenly it was like, no was not in our vocabulary. Whatever we wanted as kids, it was like, yeah, let's do it. You want to go to Fiesta, Texas and skip church? Let's go and we'll go to confession next week, you know? If you want ice cream for breakfast, let's put a scoop on top of your waffle. It was like anything we wanted, we got. And, you know, again, I'm not questioning it. We started traveling like crazy. We went on a cruise to Alaska to look at the glaciers, and we spent a few weeks in Guatemala with some of my mom's old friends. We even spent a week on a boat traveling through the Galapagos Islands off the coast of Ecuador. I mean, this was like, I'm telling you, idyllic childhood. It was incredible. So it turns out that aside from a workaholic doctor dad able to fund all this adventuring, the secret to a truly epic childhood is a terminally ill mom. Oh, yeah. Who knew? So what we didn't know, what my brother and I didn't know at the time, that the reason behind all this adventuring was an ALS diagnosis. So for those of you who were not made aware by the 2014 viral ice bucket challenge, ALS is a fatal neurodegenerative disease that causes all of your motor neurons to die off. So at the end, patients are left fully paralyzed. They require breathing machines and feeding tubes and those Stephen Hawking style talking computers. And it's brutal. It's totally brutal. But just like my mom never did anything halfway in life, she was not about to die halfway. So we're going to keep the enjoyment going for as long as we can until the wheels fell off. So while we were doing all this adventuring, unaware of the diagnosis, Mom was slowly losing her mobility. She started out using two walking sticks by the dark side road trip. She was using a wheelchair. And then by that fall, she was using a walker. By that fall, she was in a wheelchair. And they couldn't keep it a secret anymore. Mom was going to die. But knowing this, we kept the enjoyment going. She asked two of her artist friends to, she commissioned this coffin table and threw a huge party, essentially a living wake. And all of her friends from her past lives came to celebrate and kind of send her off. For my 9th birthday, the last birthday that I would spend with her, she borrowed a stretcher from the fire department and instructed us to wrap her in blankets and duct tape her to it so she could be carried to the top of Enchanted Rock by my dad and some of her friends. So I'm sure you can imagine we got a lot of interesting looks that day because you don't expect to see someone on a stretcher going up the mountain. But that was my mom. In the last year of her life, we spoke freely and openly about the end and everything that would come after. I remember sitting in her lap and coming up with a list of places where we would spread her ashes after she was gone to kind of continue the adventure in her memory. She even made a list of women that she thought my dad should date. So the end was coming and we were going to be as prepared as anybody could be. We celebrated the new millennium together, and 2 weeks later, we said goodbye at home while listening to Dark Side of the Moon. So here we are, 25 years later. Am I frightened of dying? Maybe. I'm a mom now, and I can't imagine being told that I won't be able to see my child grow up. But I'm certainly not afraid of discussing the inevitability of death. And, you know, with everything that ALS took from my mom, it gave us the gift of certainty and time to enjoy what time we had left. So while my son's childhood might not contain the same level of adventure as mine did, it certainly will contain a lot of joy and appreciation for our precious lives, hopefully without the threat of imminent death.
This is an amazing tribute to your mother, Lydia. Thank you for sharing a little bit of her life.
This program was made possible by the City of San Antonio Department of Arts and Culture, striving to enrich the quality of life of San Antonio residents and visitors by creating art programming and helping people experience art. For this and more information, visit getcreativesanantonio.com.
Our next storyteller is Erica Cash. Erica shares a story about a realization she reached after a couple of dates.
Ago, I got out of a long-term relationship after a particularly difficult stretch in my health. When the relationship ended, I was able to focus on doctor recommendations and treatments, and my health began to improve. So I decided to dip my toes into the dating pool again. My first post-breakup date was with a chemistry PhD student in Austin. We went to some trendy spots. Lots of reclaimed wood and overpriced coffee was noted. And on paper, I thought we could connect. At the very least, I thought we could discuss, I don't know, the perils of grad school or something. But there were definitely some red flags from the start. He was tall and seemingly smart, but he had a controlling streak that peaked out when he reached over to close my sweater, deciding for me that I was showing too much cleavage. Well, the date felt awkward, I thought, but nothing would prepare me for what would happen after. Later that evening, he called me and he said, "Well, I've been thinking. I was feeling kind of anxious after the date. I thought it went pretty well, but I really want to be able to climb a mountain with my future wife." Oddly specific. And I definitely don't want my future children to have a disease. First of all, eugenics man, what makes you think I would want to have kids with you anyway? Secondly, ouch. This depressed me, not because of the opinion of this pseudo-intellectual chemist, but because I was worried that this is what dating would be. After all, I am a children's psychotherapist. I help children process grief, trauma, abuse, and just the difficulties of being a child. I think at the very least I'd be an okay mom, maybe. So these words of his stirred up some feelings I've had for a long time, particularly feelings of defectiveness. I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS. It is a connective tissue disorder, basically meaning that the glue holding my body together is more like bubble gum than super glue. It's an autosomal dominant hereditary condition, meaning that I have a 50-50% chance of passing it on to children. So EDS has not only shaped my connective tissue and my nervous system, but also the way that I experience the world. Growing up with EDS wasn't easy. Joint dislocations, fainting, and a heart rate that will spike up to 160, probably like right now, was all pretty commonplace for me. But when I was 2 years old, I actually experienced my first joint dislocation. I was left screaming in a daycare high chair, neglected and alone. Nobody really understood when I fainted in choir class or when I dislocated my shoulder during a game of tag. "You're being dramatic," they would tell me, or worse, "You're just lazy." One particularly scarring moment happened in high school. I fainted one morning before class, and I went to go find the school nurse. And the school, while I was there, my heart rate would not go below 160. So she, instead of helping me and bandaging my bloodied hands, she accused me of being high. I was stunned. How can I even begin to clarify a misunderstanding like that when my body symptoms already feel like a betrayal? Well, luckily, not every date was like that first date that I mentioned, thankfully. The second date I went on also ended in a way I didn't expect. So on Christmas Eve, I met up with a Korean pilot who had traveled to America to obtain his commercial pilot's license. We walked around a local university campus. It was pretty quiet and peaceful during the holiday break. He began to tell me about his life in Korea and how he often had feelings of defectiveness. He told me that his darker skin set him apart from others and how his teachers and classmates would tell him that he wouldn't amount to anything and he was trouble. He explained to me about Korea's caste system that perpetuates some of these assumptions, that somebody's worth and success can be tied to the color of their skin, to their genetics. He, despite this, was able to come to America and follow his dreams, but this was mostly inspired by his favorite movie, an American sci-fi movie called Gattaca. Now, I've never seen this movie, but in Gattaca, according to him, society has embraced genetic engineering to the point where designer humans are the norm, and those born naturally, like the protagonist Vincent Freeman, are labeled as defective and even denied opportunities based off of their genetic inferiority. Sounds familiar. Vincent, born with a heart defect and a predicted lifespan of only 30 years, always wanted to be an astronaut, but that was reserved for the genetically elite. The core message of Gattaca is that human potential isn't defined by your genes. It is defined by your ambition, determination, and grit. It really did mirror the pilot's dream. So this story, the pilot's favorite movie, him and his favorite movie, left a lasting impact on me, particularly due to how it mirrored my own challenges. What did I learn from these two dates? Well, I learned from the first that some people with a degree in chemistry think it qualifies them to practice social Darwinism. It doesn't. And from the second, that even in the most unexpected moments, somebody can remind you that your worth isn't tied to your challenges. So life will always have its critics. Some might even have a PhD. But don't let them define you. Be like Vincent Freeman. Defy the odds, rewrite the rules, and reach for the stars, literally. And be a pilot, an astronaut, or even a mom with connective tissue made of bubblegum.
Sometimes a good sci-fi movie will help highlight your own hero's journey.
This program is made possible by the Lifshutz Foundation, an arts, culture, and humanities fundraising organization.
Worth Repeating relies on supporters like you. Supporting your favorite programs is important now more than ever. I ask you every show, and now I'm asking you every podcast. If Worth Repeating is a program that you turn to with fidelity, consider becoming a new or increasing your sustaining membership. You can do so by visiting tpr.org and clicking the red donate button today. You can leave a personalized note and tell them Tori said, meow, 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 meow. Our final storyteller is Francis Bettes. Francis shares a story about a family curse.
I've never seen a picture of my grandmother, no matter what age, where she doesn't look fucking old and angry. At the age of 14, she had her first child, and by 33, her last and 11th child, my mother. Her and my grandpa lived in a small two-bedroom shack in Laredo, Texas, in the very poor neighborhood of Cantarranas. What they didn't know when they moved in was that they would be moving in to two really weird neighbors. Their names were Licha and Chalo, and for some weird reason, Licha and Chalo loved to watch my grandparents' property through the chain link fence that separated them. My grandma would often catch them just standing there like the Shining twins, expressionless and silent. Sometimes she would catch Licha whispering under her breath, and Chalo would be standing next to her like a puppet, not saying a word. This went on for so many months until my grandparents got tired of their behavior and decided to construct a cinder block wall to obstruct their creepy gazes. Licha and Chalo took great offense to the construction of this wall and decided one day after it was done to take sledgehammers and try to knock it down. You see, Licha and Chalo were not your run-of-the-mill peeping Toms. No. These guys were into the occult. Back then, Licha was known as the town's black magic witch. Day and night, people from all over Laredo and Nuevo Laredo would come to her house and have her cast spells and curses on people. And if there's one thing you don't do to your town's bruja is call the fucking cops on her. So one night after the police were called, they were charged with vandalism and property damage. One night after the police were called, One of my aunts woke up at 3 a.m. to find Licha standing outside the door. She runs to my grandmother and wakes her up. Ma, Licha's outside. My grandma jumps out of bed, runs to the front door, and opens it to find Licha gone. On the floor, a neatly wrapped loaf of white Wonder Bread. She picks it up and sees that in between each slice is this weird white powdery substance mixed with corn husk hairs. Angry, it's 3 a.m, she's cranky, barefoot, she, in her vata, her nightgown, runs next door screaming at the top of her lungs, Licha, sal cabrona, which means, come out, bitch. The only person brave enough to follow her is her youngest, 11th child, my mother, who witnessed the entire event. So she's out there screaming, sal cabrona, pinche pendeja, vieja fea. Licha and Chalo come out of their house, again, expressionless and silent, and just stare at her. They might as well have been saying, red rum, red rum. So my grandmother's out there yelling at the top of her lungs, pinche pendeja, you think I'm afraid of you, you fucking bitch? I'm not afraid of the fucking devil. This is what I think of your black magic voodoo bullshit. So she then grabs a loaf of bread above her head and rips it apart and shakes all the contents onto herself. Her face is covered in the white powder and her hair has the corn husk hairs. Maybe a little bit got on my mom, who's probably crying next to her. I'm a bigger witch than you are, bitch. And you know what, Licha? I know how you're gonna fucking die. You're gonna choke on your tongue for all the spells and curses that you put on innocent people, and you're gonna die alone. Pendeja. At this point, my mom's crying, dragging her back home, and they go to sleep. Licha and Chalo didn't give her the response that she was expecting. This is the part of the story where I think that maybe my grandmother did unintentionally curse my entire family. You see, not one single person in my stereotypically gigantic Mexican family has lived a normal, uncursed life. Every single person has had some form of trauma or tragedy affect them. If I were to stand up here and tell you every single thing that has happened to every person, I'd be up here for like 2 weeks. But I can give you guys a couple examples. My grandmother's firstborn son died in a freak car accident at the age of 37, where his infant son was the sole survivor. Another one of my aunts had a gun pointed to her head by her abusive husband while holding their newborn son. Another one of my uncles was in a work explosion where he broke an ungodly amount of bones in his body and was in a coma for a couple months. Another one of my aunts has severe bipolar disorder. Two of my uncles have been incarcerated. More than half of the 11 siblings are alcoholics or recovering. My mom's a Jehovah's Witness. Thank you. And the list just goes on and on. The curse has even bled into my generation, the second generation of 27 cousins, with me being number 27. Again, I could be up here, that's a story for another time, about how it's affected all of us. But I know you guys wanna know the cheese, you wanna know how the curse affected me. This is hard to say in front of all of my family, but it's really hard being the most beautiful and talented person. It's a weight that I carry on my shoulders so heavily. And this hair doesn't do itself. In 2011, at the age of 14, my grandmother passed away from multiple myeloma, which is a rare cancer of the blood. I remember not crying at her funeral because I wasn't that close to her. And quite frankly, she was actually pretty abusive. Sometimes I wonder if the Wonder Bread curse never even existed, and maybe my mom just made it all up, or that it was, you know, generational trauma, and the tragedies that have affected all of us are just our way of dealing with that. But I think the Wonder Bread curse is way cooler to say. So. I guess we'll never know. But I can tell you guys one thing. 4 decades after the Wonder Bread incident, Licha did end up dying alone in her nursing home from diabetic complications that resulted in her tongue swelling up, leading her to choke on it, just like my grandmother said she would. Thank you.
Never underestimate the power of a woman scorned or Wonder Bread. That's it for the Worth Repeating podcast. Do us a favor and give us a like, subscribe, or review us wherever you stream podcasts. Support for Worth Repeating comes from the 8020 Foundation, the City of San Antonio Department of Arts and Culture, and the Lifshutz Foundation. Worth Repeating is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Tori Poole. Thanks for listening.